It was a relief to hear the jury verdict this week, finding responsibility for the very public execution of George Floyd, separate from anyone's personal conclusions about culpability was, of course, the threat of more violence should yet another killing of an African-American man go seemingly unresolved. But of course, the verdict would not have been unexpected were systemic racism not so insidiously entrenched in our society, especially in the criminal justice system. With thoughts on this week's events, as well as the context in which they played out, I am very grateful to be joined once again by Martin Luther King III, the oldest son of the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Martin, I am really grateful for you being back with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, Dr. Gaddy. I'm certainly honored to have the opportunity to be with you again during this very significant moment in the history of our nation and really our world. The tragedy almost 1 year ago on May 25th of 2020, the tragic death, as you said, I will say it a slightly different way. Mm-hmm. The officer became judge, jury, and executioner all in one, but was convicted. And so a whole movement, it seems, was launched around this tragic death of this man, which certainly did not have to happen.
Our society is so polarized today that I'd like to have you start with why you think this outcome in Minnesota is so important.
So I think the outcome is so important because for any number of cases that have come up, and we've seen, unfortunately, these types of incidents where Black men and now Black women as well, oftentimes have been killed by police in questionable activities. And oftentimes it has not been chronicled. I would say that while this is not something new, it always or oftentimes has taken place. But for the last, 10, 12 years, we've had the capacity to capture it on our telephones, so through our smartphones and devices. And while it seems like it happens more theoretically, not just theoretically, practically. Mm-hmm. As you would know, my father and his team were dealing with this 53 years ago. Yeah. And obviously way before then, before him, this kind of thing was going on. So the issue today in 2021 is that for the first time in the history of Minnesota, a police officer was charged and convicted for three different charges. The police officer was guilty of all of these charges by the jury's omission, and so that is really historic. When you look at the number of cases that are still going on, the fact of the matter is even during this particular trial, Dante Wright was also killed by an officer who stopped him on a traffic violation, they said, and then he ended up being killed, and the officer said it was an accident. She meant to tase him, she said. Mm. But the fact of the matter is, what are the chances that while deliberation would be going on, another case would occur where an African-American man who did not have a weapon was attempting to be apprehended and was killed. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, on the day of deliberation, now this one is still developing because there's a lot of information that has to be gathered. But a young lady, Makia Bryant, in Columbus, Ohio, police came up and she did have a knife. So that's where the question is. But it was a 15 or 16 year old girl. And the officer pulls out the gun. Maybe she did not hear him. We don't know. But boom, 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 four shots, and she's killed. Yeah. A 16-year-old girl. Now, my point on this particular case is that when are we going to learn, or will we ever decide to learn again how to apprehend suspects or assailants without killing them? It seems like that is the approach that officers are taught, to shoot, to kill. And this does not happen necessarily, you know, in other communities. It happens often in the Black community. Mm-hmm. So clearly there must be something that says, okay, when I go to, and when I say other communities, I would say the Black and brown community, and maybe in poor communities it happens, but in the white community by and large, it just does not happen. Mm-hmm. So there's something wrong, inherently wrong, with policing. Yeah. And how police are trained and engaged. And all of that are things that we have to address. Yeah.
Martin, I don't want to be too cynical, but how important do you think the live broadcast of the trial was for both the jury and the judge? Without video of the killing of George Floyd, we wouldn't be here. But what about the video of the Chauvin trial?
So I think that the video, in a sense, it sort of re-brought up the whole scenario. And I personally couldn't watch it because it was too painful to see a little girl and a young lady and an older man, all of them crying about their testimony. One was the young lady that recorded the actual incident. And thank God she was able to do that, because there would, as you say, there would not have been the evidence that was needed. The thing that made this trial probably more different than any that we've seen in recent times was the blue code of silence seemed to have been pierced. Yeah. In the sense that you had the chief of police, the lieutenant, a commanding officer, a training officer, and an emergency technician, emergency person who would provide treatment, all of them stating unequivocally that, number one, this was beyond what should have happened. It just should not have gone to that degree. Yeah. Police rarely, if ever, testify against each other. They always stick together. And while I understand that in the field, they've got to back up and support each other. But in a context where something is so crystal clear, you know, thankfully, they did come forward. And as I said, the chief, the lieutenant, the training officer, and say that this is not the kind of treatment. This is not how we trained our officers. Yeah. I think that is probably the overwhelming scenario that created the prospect for victory. But as I said, I could not watch it. It was just too emotional for me. But it did. The good thing about it was, again, it reminded the nation and the world of what was happening. Yeah. Most places and media outlets that I talked to, which were a lot around the world, in the UK and Australia and New Zealand and several other places, they were all watching, and everyone was saying, this has got to be a guilty verdict. But the reality is, the experience of the Black community is that just does not generally happen, even when there are cases that should be, you know, close and shut or open and shut cases. Mm-hmm. It just does not happen that way. So that's why I say this case perhaps is tone setting. Mm-hmm. And it may begin the process, and this is very critical, begin of some level of restoration of trust in the system, because many Black people do not trust the system because it over and over and over and over again just has not worked. But the hope is that this will be a turning moment. I don't think we can say that it will at this particular moment. I think that there are three more officers also that are charged in this case. And then as we speak, there are other cases that are evolving from, you know, from Dante Wright, which will take place. And there are many cases before that that have not gone to trial. And we just have to see if there is a change. The hope is that police officers will be put on pause. We want them to do their jobs, but we want to do them in fairness and in justice and with dignity, treating people like human beings, not going in and automatically assuming that people are wrong.
What are some of the conversations that we should be having right now across lines of ideology and race to address the broader patterns that continue to be so concerning?
That is a $100 million question. And what I mean by that is, if we have the formula or have created the formula that brings everyone to the table and at least for the most part puts us on the same page. One of the things I noticed, by the way, is many of the Fox News commentators said that justice has been done. The one that did not, who has the largest audience, is Tucker Carlson,
yeah,
and said that the jury yielded to the mob. Now, the part of the challenge is the people who people are listening to will say things like that to keep our nation at odds, as opposed to our nation wanting to work together, bringing people together. They're going to be those fringe elements who are automatically going to want to believe that, you know, this should not have happened in a relationship. The policeman was just doing his job. I think that's a very small percentage of people. I think that the overwhelming and overriding concerns, if people are truly, if we are real human and just and humane, then you almost have to come to the same conclusion. Mr. Floyd could have been arrested and apprehended, but Mr. Floyd did not have to die. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, then a person should be prosecuted. And certainly in the case of law enforcement, where they're apprehending people on a daily basis, why is it that the questions we need to be asking is, why is it that as it relates to Black people, oftentimes this ends up in a fatality? I just believe it does not have to happen. So I think we've got to have different kinds of conversations with people. We in the United States, we have all types of ethnic groups, and either we will learn, you know, to coexist together, or we will cease to exist in one sense, because, you know, you go back to the old biblical adage, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth would leave most of us without eyes and teeth.
Yeah,
I think that's why, you know, the philosophy of nonviolence that Dad and so many others have advocated is so important in our society, because if we start from the premise that we're going to treat everybody the way we want to be treated, many of the conflicts probably can be resolved. The fact of the matter is, we don't really often treat people the way we want to be treated. We feel like we have to do something different for whatever reason. Yes, some of it might be racism and hatred. And as it relates to racism and hatred, we have laws. Dad used to say, you know, I can't change a man's heart, but we can create laws to prevent someone from lynching me or knowing that there will be consequences if you do something that extreme. So, but there have been cases where individuals' hearts have been changed who were racist. I know of individuals who used to be in the Klan, I mean, this is years back, and they transformed and became the greatest advocates for, you know, inclusion, for diversity. So that says to me that there's hope. We can never give up on a person, because, you know, hatred is something that's taught. I do not believe that any child comes in our world having hatred. Yeah, you have personality traits and differences, but you do not, the hatred, racism is a learned behavior.
Yeah.
My grandfather used to say incorrectly, he'd say, now I know this grammatically is not correct, but it's true in what he said. He said, and he said this, he said, he also said that maybe this is not grammatically correct, but he would say that the hardest thing to do is to unlearn that which has been learned. So learned behavior, racism, It's challenging to get people to change those views, but we do know that it can work. Yeah. And we need to be having these sensitivity and human relations and diversity conversations over and over again. We need to have this training. In fact, we could probably address many of these issues by looking at our system of education and beginning this, this sensitivity, human relations, diversity, inclusion in kindergarten and teaching it all the way through high school. And at the end of the day, we would have a different kind of student, a different kind of young person. So whatever views that were taught may be at home, something else is taught in the system where you get most of your academic learning. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it gives you the ability to make different choices than what you may be, you know, yes, what you're taught at home has an overwhelming amount of influence on you. But we often see young people, their parents may be of one ilk, but they have a different perspective. So at some point they grow up and they become, they have the ability to make their own decisions, and their decisions may be different than their parents. So that means that we should be theoretically an evolving society, not a society that devolves. What we've done is we've created various boxes and restrictions, and even our religions do that. That's perhaps was done to control people, as opposed to, you know, we say we have free will, but you know that the rules in this particular box say you have to act this way or else. And, you know, I'm not sure that that's the best way. I do think that we need to have and always elevate our faith. But I don't think that I think that sometimes our religious indoctrinations have created more separatism than that to bring people together. So I think we've got to do a better job of creating an environment, creating a teaching and training that is more expansive than limiting. And what we do is we, for example, we're going through the issue of voting right rights issues and suppressions. Tragically, in Georgia, we've passed some draconian laws, and there are these proposed laws in over 47 states that may be bought on the books. I don't know how many will actually create the laws, but there are about six or seven, maybe eight states that have passed these laws. And that's really short-sighted. We should use all these opportunities we can to expand the right to vote, to make it as easy as possible, not to restrict the right and those who might be voting. And so, it just means we got to keep working. You can never just give up.
What counsel would your dad give for the situation for where we are right now? Would he be calling for healing, or would he be talking solely about justice?
No, I think it would be both and. It would be, you know, justice always needs to occur. And frankly, if there was justice, maybe there wouldn't be some of the confrontations, the violence that we see from time to time. One of the things that has not universally been reported is the fact that when we saw the demonstrations in the summer last year after George Floyd's tragic execution, there were demonstrations in every state in the United States. There were demonstrations, civil rights demonstrations in Europe, in Australia, on the African continent, in South America, in Canada. So just about the entire planet had levels of demonstrations going on. And 89, this was the statistic that was not reported much, 89%, almost 90% of those demonstrations were peaceful. What ends up happening is the 10% that were not is where oftentimes the media focuses, and it seems to discredit the whole movement. When in fact, we should be saying, yes, we got to do better with these 10%, but it's wonderful that almost 90% were peaceful. And, you know, I don't know what the numbers are now in terms of the demonstrations that are taking place, but generally they are more peaceful demonstrations than they are violent demonstrations. Now, what Dad said was the riots are the language of the unheard. So he never, you know, condoned violence. He was adamantly against violence, always advocated for nonviolence and tried to present that image. But he also understood why people sometimes felt forced into, you know, sometimes engaging in behavior that is not productive, that becomes somewhat non-creative. In other words, and he even said in his speeches, you know, he would say the darkness cannot put out darkness. Only light can do that. Violence can't put out violence. Only nonviolence and love can do that.
I've been wanting to ask you a question about our mutual friend, the Reverend Warnock, now in the United States Senate. What a crucial win that was. Also, there's significance in the fact that he has long served in the pulpit where your dad was. And I just wonder, how has that felt to you and the family of how that all has worked out?
Well, I think that it is extraordinarily significant. Number one, it was significant that Dr. Warnock was able to win as the first black senator from the state of Georgia. That was profound and significant. But secondly, he had been doing this kind of work around all kind of social justice issues. But now he has the impact, the ability to impact it through legislation and to be among his colleagues as a United States senator and actually vote to create law. That is so significant. And we're so proud of what he is doing. Georgia also elected its first Jewish senator, which is great. But Dr. Warnock is doing an outstanding job as the first African-American senator from the state of Georgia.
Martin Luther King III is the oldest son of the late civil rights hero, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who today serves as chairman of the Drum Major Institute, carrying the work of his father into the 21st century. I can't thank you enough for being with us. You keep doing what good work you're doing. We'll come back to you, and we'll have this again.
Look forward to it.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, Dr.
Okay.
Gay.